Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I am the conscience of psychiatry. I don't think there's another radio show in the world where you can hear so many wonderful, positive approaches to the field that we call mental health, or where you can hear so many honest critiques of biological psychiatry, drugs, electroshock, and psychiatric diagnosis. Now, of utmost important, 3 days is all you have before our annual conference. Our empathic therapy conference starts Thursday, actually starts Friday. Get there Thursday evening because it starts in the morning. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, April 13th, 14th, and 15th. That's just this coming Friday. That's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I say that for my benefit as much as yours. It's going to be as good as last year, and I think even better. And last year, most folks agreed it was the best conference they'd ever been to. We'll start out in the morning on Friday with me. I don't hog a lot of time at this conference. I'll talk for an hour, maybe a day. But I'll start out talking about why we need empathic therapy instead of biopsychiatry. And then today's guest, Gerald Porter, is going to talk about the future and the promise of empathic therapy and its relationship to the psychological sciences. Then we'll have a nice coffee break with some goodies, all part of the pretty low charge that we make. Under $300 for the whole conference with a number of meals in there and a chocolate fountain on Monday night. We really have it down to bare bones costs. Then after the break, we'll get sober and serious for an hour. We're going to do a discussion on tardive dyskinesia, the terrible disorder of movement that afflicts so many people taking drugs like Geodone and Zyprexa and Abilify and Seroquel and Haldol, the antipsychotic drugs. I'm going to show for about 8 minutes, not a long time, some films of people who get this disorder so you can have an idea of the seriousness. And then we're going to have a discussion with attorney Larry Berlin about tardive dyskinesia and legal cases. Then at noon, we have a presenter from Britain who's going to come and talk about the whole issue of voluntary and involuntary in mental health. After the, this is just Friday, after the lunch break, we're going to have workshops on things like a new model for diagnosis and therapy. We're going to have a panel of people talking about, these are alternative sessions you can choose from, talking about opposition to ECT. We're going to have an interesting talk on empathy, compassion, and the light, what we have learned from 35 years of near-death studies. This is Barbara Whitfield talking about near-death studies and empathy and caring. We'll have more breakouts on things like children in distress, and then on treating people who have been mistreated by psychiatry, then a marvelous full plenary session on working with the elderly in an empathic way. Then in the evening, we're going to have the chocolate fountain, where we get together with the authors and everyone who wants to come. And this conference is open to anybody concerned about these issues, not limited at all to professionals. You'll be very comfortable as someone who's been through the psychiatric mill coming. You'll be comfortable as someone who's got a family member or just someone who's interested in these issues. We have a full day on Saturday. Joanne Cacciatore is coming from Arizona to talk about grief and grief recovery. In the evening, we're going to have a dessert time. And then Bertrand Caron, I think one of the great men of psychology, will be having an evening chat with me for all of you to join in on about psychology, what it is, where it's going. And just on and on. We just have really good things right through Sunday afternoon. So sign up on empathictherapy.org, empathictherapy.org. Or go to my website, bregin.com, BREGGIN.com. And you'll see a couple of places where you can go right to the conference and sign up. We have some places left. We're going to come near filling. We might fill. I think we're just going to come near filling the hotel capacity for a conference. And just, you know, sign up and come. This is going to be a wonderful occasion. Now, my guest today on the show is the second speaker after me at the conference, my friend, my colleague, Gerald Porter. Jerry is vice president for academic affairs at the Forest Institute in Springfield, Missouri. The Forest Institute is a private, nonprofit, accredited doctoral and master's program, and it gives a PsyD. And along the way here, we'll talk about the differences between a PhD and a PsyD, which are quite interesting for people who are involved in the field. Jerry has worked on all kinds of different administrative levels and educational levels. I met him when he was the dean of the school that I teach at, SUNY Oswego, the Department of Counseling and Pupil Personnel Services. And it's just a pleasure to welcome my friend Jerry Porter. Hi, Jerry.
How are you, Peter? Great to be here. Well,
oh, it's just nice. It's nice to be in your presence. I'm looking so forward to seeing you in a few days.
Yeah.
And I hope your wife will get a chance to stop by at some point in the conference and say hello too.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You know, Peter, one of the things I wanted to say is the conference is really a wonderful experience. I think it's great for professionals, but as you said, I thought it was also incredibly helpful for people who have perhaps been through the psychiatric mill, as you said, and are looking for answers or alternatives. I have to say that I found the presentations to not only be informative, but often really moving as people shared their experiences. So it's a wonderful opportunity for anybody who has a concern about mental health issues.
It was very moving. There were deeply empathic experiences, particularly the panel last year, and we're going to have a similar but not identical panel this year on people who had lost loved ones through suicide and murder, where the person who suicided or murdered was under the influence of psychiatric drugs, usually the antidepressants. That was very moving. But it came out positive in the long run because of the way people survived with such strength and took part in a reform movement. Mm-hmm. So it is both moving and uplifting. It was a wonderful conference last year, and we're really looking forward to doing that again.
Yeah.
Thank you
and,
for the plug.
And it's so important.
I think, as
people.
I recall, you stayed and went to the whole conference.
Oh,
you
I did. Absolutely.
You just didn't give a talk and run.
I did not. I gave my two cents and then stayed for the rest. And I think it's really great for people to hear alternatives, that there really are alternatives, and that there are, you know, mental health practitioners, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, who laypersons who really care about this and are really trying to do something to help people find another way.
Jerry, tell us about the Forest Institute and what you do there and what it has to offer in Springfield, Missouri.
Sure. Well, let me just say one thing. By the way, I was chair of the Department of Counseling and Psychological Services at Forrester. Oswego. I wasn't dean. I was dean someplace.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay. I don't want my colleagues at Oswego to be upset.
I gave you a promotion. I guess dean would be of the School of Education, wouldn't it?
Right. And I was a dean at Cortland, SUNY Cortland, but that was another story. So anyway,
you were dean someplace else.
Forrester Institute. You
were my department chair, and a wonderful one you were. You're one of the reasons I kept teaching there.
Because
you were there running it.
And and that was a great opportunity for our students. Forrester Institute, where I am right now, is a school of professional psychology. We're kind of growing beyond that, I think, at this stage. But we have, as you mentioned, a Doctor of Psychology program, a PsyD, in clinical psychology, with concentrations in child adolescent, in primary care psychology, in neuropsychology, in forensics. And we also have master's programs in marriage and family therapy, in clinical psychology, in counseling psychology. We've got certificate programs in applied behavior analysis. I think we provide a wide range of programs in mental health for people who are interested in these areas.
Now, what's the difference between a PsyD and a PhD? I know, but it's really not generally known.
Sure. Well, a PhD is primarily preparing people not only to, let's take, for example, clinical psychology. A PhD in clinical psychology trains people to be clinicians, but also there is often the expectation that people will go on to do research or become academics. And so the discipline of psychology emerged in the 19th century out of philosophy and, very traditional academic program where the terminal degree was a PhD, and that PhD, for example, culminated in doing original research and writing a dissertation. PsyDs are, I think, every bit as rigorous as PhDs, but the emphasis is not so much on doing research or on, becoming an academic. Teaching, the emphasis is on being highly skilled practitioners. And so, although students who go through a PsyD program will do a considerable amount of work in psychometrics and so on, they are really trained more to be consumers of the literature and to figure out how can I apply the scientific literature to my practice as a clinician in a skillful and critical way, as opposed to being people who actually generate that research. And similarly, there is more opportunity for clinical training while still within the context of the PsyD program than you typically will find in PhD programs. Now, that's not to say that some folks who get a PsyD in psychology don't go and teach or do research, because some certainly do, but it's a question of the emphasis of the program. And so, I think years ago there was a recognition that there was a great need for clinicians, that we needed more people to get out there and actually provide clinical services, we needed to have more psychologists, and this PsyD movement, I think it's fair to say, it was a movement that emerged in the 1970s and through the 80s and into the present, was a response to that recognition.
I view clinical psych as being very closely tied to the psychiatry in my experience. It takes a very imaginative, independent person trained in traditional clinical psych to really stand up to biopsychiatry and the diagnoses and the drugs. Do you think there's more hope for PsyD programs where there's more emphasis perhaps on therapy to provide really care that's independent of the burdens of psychiatry?
Well, I would hope so. I certainly would hope so. I mean, graduates of PsyD programs are like you find in any profession. There's a wide range of perspectives. But I think with the emphasis that you find on clinical practice, there's a higher awareness and sensitivity to the needs of clients, the needs of the people that we serve. And so, I certainly think that, you know, clinical psychology is going through a challenging period in its development as a profession because of what's happening with healthcare in the nation. And there's so much uncertainty, that it's a time that it's not quite clear what's clinical psychology, what the practice of psychology is going to look like in 5 or 10 years, or certainly 20 years. It's not clear. Certainly, the old model is rapidly losing ground.
Yeah. It would be interesting to see in what direction the world goes. Where the DSM right now is being rewritten, as many of us know. I was just looking at their rewriting of dementia. They've decided that dementia is not a politically correct word.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've come up with an alternative about severe neurocognitive disability or something like that. And I think what they're going to do more and more is get rid of the idea that there's any distinction between a genuine biological disorder like a dementia and something like schizophrenia that people get diagnosed as schizophrenia or bipolar, where there is no brain disorder and no brain disease develops over time and no neurological symptoms develop, whereas in dementia that's a term we've reserved for the strictly biological phenomena. And I think what they're doing by getting rid of dementia is they're trying to really fudge this distinction so badly that this label will be able to be applied to a variety of problems that are more psychological than they are biological, so it can all be just totally confused. I see psychiatry's survival being based now on people being very confused about the distinction between psychology and neurology and just blurring those distinctions and giving everybody drugs as if they have neurological disorders. I'm afraid that's that sort of an aside that just struck me today. I think that's the direction we're going in. And I sure hope that at some point, psychology and especially the PsyD programs like yours are going to fight back against that and say, no, there is a difference between a psychological phenomena, a psychological problem, and a brain disease. And
absolutely,
that's what dementia is all about. It's about having a brain disease.
Yeah. Well, I think, it's in the interest of psychiatry as a profession to really support biological models of behavioral difficulties, behavioral and emotional difficulties.
Yeah.
And so, you can really take this back to, say, the 1950s, when there was really psychology was very much virtually a failed specialty within medicine, and what emerged in the 1960s and 70s was the anti-psychiatry movement, which really challenged the assumptions of biological models of behavioral and emotional difficulty, and really looked at those kinds of psychosocial causes, larger ecological causes. And then I think what we saw beginning in the 1970s and gaining more and more momentum through the 80s and 90s is the reassertion of the dominance of psychiatry within mental health, so that the assumption that is implicit now in all, quote, mental disorders that we see identified in the DSM is that they're biologically determined, that these are essentially biological disorders, even if we don't know at this point what the biological cause is. And the success of psychiatry as a specialty within medicine of asserting itself as the dominant profession within mental health has meant that all the other mental health disciplines have had to find a place within that medical system that that has emerged. And so we certainly see that creating real challenges for psychologists, and so much so that we see psychology being reconceptualized as behavioral health. So it's being fit into a medical model, and this medicalization, although it certainly makes sense strategically for psychology to pursue that so that it has a place at the table, that it has a voice, it nevertheless raises real questions about what is it that psychology has to uniquely offer this very essential quest that we have to heal people and to make them whole and to resolve the kinds of behavioral and emotional difficulties that, that people are afflicted with.
I'm with you 100%. I just went to the DSM-5 development page, and the technical, the new technical language for dementia, which I didn't get exact from memory, is major neurocognitive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Major. What do you bet they're going to be pushing into those concepts, into that concept of major neurocognitive disorder, a hodgepodge of biological and psychological problems? And in fact, they've taken out any neurological signs at all, strict neurological signs like aphasia, apraxia, which are neurological phenomena, are removed from it in this new rendition. And at the bottom, this is, reminds me of something. At the bottom of this page, it says, they're talking about they're bragging about themselves, the American Psychiatric Association, representing 36,000 physician leaders. Look at that, physician, not even psychiatrists, physician leaders in mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 36,000 may sound like a large number, but wow, that's a drop in the bucket of all the mental health practitioners.
Yeah.
I'll bet there must be hundreds of thousands of non-medical mental health practitioners. Not to put you on the spot, I want to put myself on the spot because I don't know the answer, but there must be many, many, many more psychologists than 36,000, and many more school psychologists and counselors and social workers. It must be many, many times that. Have you got any rough idea, Jerry?
I don't have an idea, but I think that your point is really well taken. Is that
let's let the people who represent the most take over more.
Yeah. Well, how do these diagnostic categories get formulated? It basically is, you know, a 21st century version of the smoke-filled room. You know, it's a bunch of overwhelmingly psychiatrists who get together, and yes, they do look at some empirical data, and in some cases there are empirical studies that inform the decisions that they make, but it's a judgment call that's made by these, hopefully and presumably, highly experienced clinicians about the best way to conceptualize the kinds of difficulties and problems that people come forward with. But implicit in their approach is that is a medical model. Implicit is a disease model. Implicit is that we're looking at a disease, and so it has clear biological and diagnostic markers that distinguish every disorder from every other disorder, which of course is not true, and that these different categories that we have that are identified have some kind of reliability and validity, which certainly has not been the case with the preceding DSMs. The incredible damage that comes with classification and labeling people is only addressed by trying to develop more euphemistic classifications rather than addressing the fundamental problem, which is labeling and classifying people rather than responding and treating them as whole persons. So,
with you 100%. In fact, I think we're not quite at break yet, but after break, let's you and I do something that I don't think has been done thoroughly on this show so far, which is really look at the whole problem of what's the matter with diagnosis. Maybe you and I could have a really good conversation about that.
Sure.
You know, you mentioned that these guys, and mostly men, and are coming from the medical model, and of course it's even more, as you know, it's even more pernicious than that. They're coming from the drug company funding trough.
Yeah.
So that in the last DSM, where we have data, 100% of the people on the DSM committees for depression and psychosis and schizophrenia, these very big categories, 100% of them had drug company funding or employed in one way or another by drug companies,
yeah.
And overall, the vast majority in all categories were. And so they keep tailoring this stuff to make it look suitable as best as possible for drug company advantages. I don't think there's any question about it whatsoever.
Well, if you can reduce all behavioral and emotional difficulties to biological problems, and you can reduce it to biological problems, then it becomes a material problem, quite literally, that can be resolved by the intervention of a material product, a drug. And that fits, that really fits into, an economic system, whereas if you have an approach to behavioral and emotional difficulties that emphasizes a sort of larger ecological system that people are embedded in, that requires that society in some sense has to change. And that's a big order. So one fits into our existing economic system and political system, and the other requires that there's going to have to be some kind of systemic change so there are powerful forces that are mobilized that are supporting the direction that psychiatry is going in, powerful economic forces.
I'm talking with my friend Jerry Porter, who is at the Forest Institute in Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri, and it's a PsyD program. It's the kind of place, I'm free to say, that a young person or an older person thinking of becoming a therapist might choose to look into. I think the PsyD programs in general, I'm familiar with a few of them, are one of the better bets for becoming a good and an effective therapist. When we come back, I'm going to remind you once again about the wonderful conference that's coming up. And then I'd like to have a more in-depth than usual discussion with Dr. Porter about psychiatric diagnosis, where it falls short, and what we really need. Stay with us.
You're
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I am the conscience of psychiatry. I say that in grave terms. It's actually not a light role to have. The subject I've been discussing, or want to get into some more with Dr. Jerry Porter from the Forest Institute in St. Louis, Missouri.
Actually, Peter, we're in Springfield, Missouri.
Springfield. Thank you. Springfield, Missouri. Do you have a branch in St. Louis? Or
we do. We do have a branch in St. Louis as well.
That's where I got confused. Thank you. Thank you. You know, I do believe in medical diagnoses. I just published a paper that you can take a look at on my website, published in the International Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine, on chronic brain impairment. So it's interesting that both the DSM people and me are trying to think about this issue of dementia and what else we need. Well, the problem, the main problem with the concept of dementia, in some ways, and in some ways I agree with the DSM people, they're saying it's very stigmatizing. The way I'd put it is that doctors only want to see it as a very bad, dreadful situation, and so they never want to diagnose a patient with dementia if it's been caused by psychiatric treatment. So you can have what looks exactly like dementia as a result of shock treatment and have it described in the scientific paper, and it looks just like shock treatment in the scientific paper. I'm thinking of a paper by Sackheim, S-A-C-K-E-I-M, and a group of others. You can find that on my website, and I've written about it on my Huffington Post blog. And they'll give all this, they'll look long-term at ECT, and they'll describe all these terrible things that happen to people, but they won't call it dementia, because they don't want you to think you can get dementia from a psychiatric treatment. And many, many people now long-term on psychiatric drugs are getting the signs and symptoms of dementia. But it isn't as severe as doctors generally like to use that term, and in some ways it actually is a more mild phenomena. So I've developed this concept of CBI, or chronic brain impairment, to describe the results of head injuries of various kinds, brain injuries of various kinds that fall short of dementia, and in particular those that are caused by psychiatric medications, ECT, and ECT. Our conference is going to be marvelous. I gave you some of the Friday events. Let me tell you about a couple of the Saturday events. And we're talking about this coming Saturday, April 14th. The conference is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in Syracuse, New York, at a lovely hotel. You can get to it from my website, bragan.com, or empathictherapy.org. Saturday morning is going to start out with a panel on psychiatric drug tragedies. And last year, a similar panel was very moving and just delved into how do people handle situations where, for example, your husband murders your children when he's taking an antidepressant. There's going to be a young man there who I worked with in his legal case, who did a bunch of bizarre robberies while taking antidepressants. Then the next panel is going to be the ADHD stimulant epidemic worldwide. Marvelous Fred Bauman, neurologist from California, will be there, and Martin Whiteley, an educator and a Western Australian politician, he calls himself. And also Kevin Miller is going to be presenting. He's the filmmaker of Generation X, right after that panel. So we've got just a lot of interesting things going on. There'll be stuff about therapy and also self-help and development. One of the breakout sessions Saturday afternoon is emotional freedom techniques, faster relief of distress. Another one will be psychotherapy for depression. Another will be Alfred Adler's Individual Psychology. Another will be a critique of biopsychiatry. A lot of very interesting and very, very lively presenters. And in the afternoon, another session, a breakout that you can choose from among others, will be a psychotherapist's role in psychiatric drug withdrawal. Another will be a panel with John Snyder and some psychiatrists that he's working with on understanding depression from the viewpoint of the empathic counselor. So we're just looking at a lot of really interesting stuff. Jerry, do you have thoughts to start out with on any subject, but perhaps on diagnosis and what we need to do about it?
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, there are certain disorders which undoubtedly are biological in nature and are well served by the medical model. And we need to continue the research and work to find better and better treatments. But most or many, at least, behavioral and emotional difficulties that people have, even very severe ones, often have more psychosocial roots and origins, and it's also true, I think, that you made that phenotypically, in terms of appearance of the presenting symptoms that an individual may have, it's sometimes something that is psychosocial in origin is indistinguishable from something that is biological in origin until you really begin to explore the background.
Well, let me say that I think, of course, I come down harder on these issues perhaps than you do. I don't know of any psychiatric disorder, primary psychiatric disorder, bipolar, schizophrenia, any of the diagnoses, the anxiety disorders, OCD, ADHD, that has any convincing evidence for either a biological or a genetic basis.
Well, I would agree with that.
Go ahead.
Well, I would agree. I mean, the things that are not really examined are things like stress, fatigue, inadequate coping strategies, just poor interpersonal skill development, the lack of insight or intrapsychic awareness, inadequate social support networks, poorly developed functional skills like emotional management, poor physical health that results in or makes a person more vulnerable to things like depression and anxiety, poor diet. And so there's so many things that go almost completely unexamined or very inadequately considered. The way that the mental health system is increasingly being structured, there's very little attention given to those factors and almost exclusively an attempt to treat people with medication. So,
when I deal with my patients or clients, what I'm interested in knowing is their story. Mm-hmm. I think that the best role we can play is to help a person understand what his or her story is, how they got to be where they are, what their strengths are, what their weaker areas are, what their traumatic experiences have been that may have bent their perceptions in wrong directions, what their values are, which of their values are really promoting their lives and the lives of the people they care about and society, which of their values are getting in the way with their growth and development as well as with they're making a contribution to their loved ones and society. I come from a really value-oriented place because I think that to a great extent we sink or swim by our values, but our values themselves are often misshapen by anger and hate and resentment and fear that evolves over a lifetime. But I think that diagnosis is such an oversimplification when what we really need is to understand a story, I think about, you know, the people who like Churchill or Lincoln or Washington, people who there are lots of books written about. Some psychiatrists want to diagnose Lincoln as manic depressive or Churchill as manic depressive. I think George Washington's escaped from that. But that's because he didn't talk a lot about himself. He's very action-oriented. But to sum up a life as bipolar, or even to try to look at it as bipolar, when there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of books delving into the character of these men, I think, and of their wives as well, in the case of Washington and Lincoln, it's just absurd. We really need to see that the Western traditions of literature and art tell us that to understand a human being is a colossal, complex, subjective effort, and that a therapist should bring that respect and honoring to a person's life in any effort to understand them. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Very much so. Yeah, well, you're right. We really have to understand, how does a person construct their sense of identity? How do they construct their selfhood? How do they construct their experience of the world, their reality? And you're right, the way to do that is to really examine what's their story, what's the narrative, what significance do they place on the different elements and events that take place within that narrative. And I also appreciate what you're saying about understanding that narrative in the larger social context, because it's important to see how the individual is rooted, is anchored within the larger society, and whether they see themselves as being functional and efficacious, or whether they see themselves as being implicitly damaged or problematic or inadequate. And that's so much a part of what needs to be addressed, what needs to be treated. Yeah,
and I think these, you know, people who have been spent too much time in universities often think that these kinds of issues are just for them, you know, that they're the only people who think about their lifestyle or their existential issues or values. But I know from having a practice in a small town, I know from having friends who are working people, that in fact all human beings live by their values. Yeah. And it doesn't take an education for you to be struggling with your identity about being a good husband or being a good wife or being a father, whether you want these roles, are these roles satisfying, how to do them, how to have a job that's honorable, how to earn a decent living, how to think about politics, how to think about religion. All people think about these things, and all people struggle with painful emotions, which are sometimes embedded in these issues and sometimes embedded out of sight, in fact, you know, in childhood experiences or into trauma and stress. So I don't want the folks listening to think that this is about, you know, people who are very intellectual looking at their identities. This is really how all human beings struggle with their lives and the meaning of their lives.
Yeah. You know, yes. And, you know, part of the purpose or the constructive role that education, or for that matter, therapy can play, is it can give people additional constructs and concepts so that they can conceptualize and think about their life story in a richer, deeper way. They have more tools, if you will, in their toolbox to construct a narrative that is meaningful and rewarding and fulfilling and affirming of their implicit value as a person. So, but you're right. That's something that's everybody's that's something everybody does. It's everybody's birthright, and everybody should be encouraged and supported and nurtured in that process.
Yeah, I think that those of you listening to me who are seeking help or involved in the therapy process in some way, you'll live better without thinking of yourself or your patients as schizophrenic, bipolar, OCD, anxiety disorder in one way or another, ADHD, or any of these diagnoses, because they all stop thought. They should be called stop signs. They stop looking at who you are. So let's suppose you, well, let's look at bipolar disorder. First of all, 90% of the people being diagnosed with that really don't meet the criteria even, which are pretty stringent in the old DSM. And most people who come near meeting having the symptoms, they've gotten it from psychiatric drugs or street drugs. It's literally a neurological phenomena where they were pitched over into a state of euphoria by drugs. And only a small number would even fit what we used to call manic depressive disorder or bipolar. But let's suppose you even fit in that diagnosis. Let's suppose you were 17 years old and you went through a period of outlandish euphoria where you thought you were God and you thought you could, you already understood the nature of the universe and you thought that you were growing in your IQ at the rate of 10% per hour or whatever other ideas were driving you. Don't call yourself bipolar. Look at yourself and say, what was I going through? What would, if I was 16 or 17 or 18, what in the world was happening in my home life and my school life that I wanted to take such a wild route out of it and into another universe? What was happening to me that I was so dismal in my perspective that I thought I had to take this skyrocket shortcut into imagining my enormous superiority and grandeur? And look at it as about your life story. Don't let a diagnosis keep you from saying, who am I? How did I get there? What drove me there? What was I thinking? Why was I thinking that way? And you'd be surprised how some of the most extreme emotional reactions are the easiest to understand because they're a caricature. They're a caricature of how we respond to stresses. Yeah. And are even often more understandable than more subtle things in life. So just because you've had some severe emotional distress, or one of your patients or clients has had something that looks so bad you want to call it a psychosis, that doesn't set it out of humanity. It just makes it an extreme example, and I'd say a caricature that can often be really easy to understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I think that one of the great misconceptions is that just because a person can take a substance that will in some sense apparently reduce symptoms doesn't mean that the fundamental cause is biological.
You know, that's so good, Jerry, to bring up, because that's so illustrated by people who drink to excess to control their anxiety or their rage or their disappointment, or people who smoke dope to avoid, you know, having their real highs and lows and dealing with their feelings in a more full way. No, all these things, as I've written in my books and articles, they're all about disabling the brain. Drugs disable the brain. They do the same things to animals as they do to people. They have no specificity for any special human problem. Mm-hmm. The antipsychotic drugs will make anybody, including any animal, more apathetic, docile, easier to manage, and make them less complaining.
Mm-hmm.
Really important principle. And also the fact that a drug can drive a person into something that looks like what we call a mental disturbance. You can have a psychotic episode on marijuana. You can have it, a psychotic episode on LSD. that doesn't mean that psychotic episodes are all caused by chemistry, because in fact they look different. The person who we end up being labeled schizophrenic is generally somebody who's been struggling terribly with life. It's not an abrupt onset, radically transforming experience out of the blue. And even the person who gets a manic episode has usually been avoiding, usually been looking for shortcuts, usually had a tendency to overestimate what they're doing, and then it just gets out of hand. So you can see a continuity in the people who routinely come to see us. And by golly, if you see somebody who looks like they've had a biological sudden onset of an emotional disturbance, look for a drug or an intoxicant of some kind. These things tend to look different. They tend to have these rapid onsets. They tend to have an element of confusion and delirium that looks biologic to them. So there is a distinction, even when we have a drug-induced psychosis and a person who just works themselves into that kind of frenzy. They look different. I don't think psychiatrists are being taught this anymore. I don't know. Are clinical psychologists being, are they being exposed to these kind of conversations, Terry?
Well, I think to some extent, but, you know, I do think that the prevalence of the medical model and the assumption of biological determination really is an overriding consideration these days and tends to, you know, I think there is some kind of talk about differential diagnosis and so on. You know, you mentioned a couple things, though, that I really wanted to respond to, and that is, you know, the importance of stress in understanding, in all the different forms that it takes, the emergence of problematics, you know, behavioral or emotional difficulties. And the other is cognition. You know, people, what I have found is that when you really start examining somebody's narrative and the language that they use to talk about their story, and if you start examining not just the sort of global story, but start looking at the, if you will, individual scenes and how they're constructing and understanding themselves, you'll often find language which suggests the kind of difficulties that a person might have when that's habitual over a very sustained period of time. So, you know, for example, working with kids who have had very severe behavioral difficulties, I almost invariably find them saying things like, I'm no good, I'm a bad person, I'm inadequate, I'm stupid. Well, there are consequences for thinking that way about yourself, especially over a sustained period of time. We construct our experience, we construct our reality, and so because of that, you know, it becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And we can treat somebody by changing that narrative, changing the way that they understand themselves. It's not a question of being dishonest. It's a question of changing perspective and seeing perhaps the falsehood of those narratives that we've been talking. Things like rational emotive therapy, for example, are all about that.
So. It's a matter, I think, of understanding your autobiography and making it better.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry,
yeah.
We're just about at the end. My guest, Jerry Porter, who's going to be the second presenter on Friday morning. Any parting thoughts? We're just about at the end of our program.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that the future of mental health has enormous promise in that, you know, I don't think it's just about treating people who are afflicted with behavioral and emotional difficulties. It's also how can we take people who are managing successfully, coping successfully, and we help them be even better. And there's an enormous promise in that. And that's something that I think that the mental health disciplines need to find a way to make that more a part of what we do, and to find a way to fit that within the economic system so yeah. that it's possible for people to really to grow and develop. And boy, we really need that as a yeah. society.
Jerry, thank you so much. Listen, folks, come meet Jerry Porter. Come meet Peter Breggin. Come meet Ginger Breggin. Come meet 30 presenters from around the world talking about these kind of issues in different accents from different approaches. And I'm 100% with Jerry on this is about all of life. And that's why we call it the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy and Living and Education and Living, because we're really talking about the whole range of life. Thanks for listening. Come say hello to me at our conference in Syracuse. Look it up on empathictherapy.org. Say hello and tell me you've listened to me on the radio. Thank you very, very much.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Breggin and his lifelong reform work on www.breggin.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.